MechCast, Saturday, October 24th, 2015. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Well, we're going to have an interesting show today because it's going to be a little bit of a learning curve, at least for me, on my end. Maybe you won't notice this at all, maybe you will, but I have gone ahead and made the leap. I finally upgraded to OS X El Capitan. And one of the issues that I'm having, as you'll hear a little bit later, is some issues with the older version of GarageBand, which I used to produce this show. So here I am. I am trying out the brand new version, or the latest version of GarageBand. New to me, I guess it really is. And we'll see how well this recording goes. Hopefully it works out smoothly. I know I'm going to have a little bit of workflow differences when it comes to actually producing the chapters for the podcast. But again, we'll talk more on that later. Have a great episode lined up for you today. We got lots of new stuff to talk about. I guess this is kind of the new software, new hardware kind of episode. So we have some new hardware things to talk about. We have a lot of recent software updates to go over. Also, some more information from the source about what's happening with the new Apple TV and when we'll be able to start ordering those and all those sorts of things, and a few other kinds of odds and ends. There's a new replacement program Apple has in place, and also an interesting story related to Apple's car project and motorcycles. So we're going to get into all of that. We also have some feedback from you on Apple Watch lugs. I'm going to talk quite a bit about my transition to OS X El Capitan and talk to you about your transitions to OS X El Capitan. And then a little information on AppleCare, and got a great thing of the moment for you this week, something that I'm pretty excited about and have been having a lot of fun with. So dig in, stay tuned for all of that. But before we get going, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Squarespace. Hey, if you need to build a website, you really should check out Squarespace. And, you know, I feel like these days, almost anything you need to do, you need to make a website for. If you're in a club or an organization, you're probably going to have to put together a website. Maybe your kids are on a sports team, or you're a coach, you're putting together a website. You run a small business, or maybe even a side business. You want to build a website, or just something for fun. Maybe you want a blog, or you have the world's cutest pet and you want to make them a website. That's great, and Squarespace makes it totally simple to do that, even if you're not a programmer. And that's one of the things I love about Squarespace. Another thing I love is they kind of handle everything. So if you know you're building a website, you probably know you gotta not only put the website together and do the design, but you also have to find hosting and maybe register a domain name. Squarespace gives you all of that stuff in one package, and they give you really great and simple tools with great templates that are mobile responsive, so you don't have to worry about it looking, you know, not working on a mobile device. That's all taken care of, and their tools are drag and drop. You just put things in place. You can move things around. You can play with it before you publish it. And if you are a programmer, someone like me, and you want to dig in and get deeper and more detailed, you can get into all of the code, but they really provide all the widgets and things that you want. So if you want a map, if you want to do e-commerce, it's all built in. And so you really should check it out, and they make it very easy to check the service out as well, because you get a free trial, no credit card required. You can test it out, and their plans start at just $8 a month. And with that, you can get a free domain if you sign up for a year. So again, domain registration handled on the yearly plans. You can start your free trial today. Just go to squarespace.com/MacCast. And when you decide to sign up, make sure you use the offer code MACCAST, and you're going to get 10% off your first purchase. So big thank you to Squarespace. Squarespace, build it beautiful. Let's kick things off today talking about some of Apple's new hardware, and there's actually quite a bit of it to talk about, starting off with the new 21.5-inch 4K iMac, the Retina iMac in 21.5 inches. We've been talking about the rumors about this for a while. Apple finally released it. A little bit of the details, 4096 by 2304 screen resolution. That's 9.4 million pixels on that display. So cramming in all the 4K goodness on that one. They're using this thing called an advanced red-green phosphor LED that is giving the screen a better color balance and wider gamut range. The translation for you and me, what that really means is that we're going to notice truer, more vibrant, and more accurate colors. As a matter of fact, this backlighting or this LED lighting was also added to the upgraded 27-inch models that we're going to talk about in a bit. The processors in the 21.5-inch iMac are the fifth generation Broadwell processors, so they didn't make the bump to Skylake with this version. I guess appropriate processors in Skylake versions are really not available, I guess, for this model at this point. But the processors that are in there that are Broadwell, they start with a 3.1 gigahertz quad-core Intel i5, and you can configure that up to a quad-core Intel i7 running at 3.3 gigahertz. The graphics are Intel Integrated Iris Pro 6200. There are no discrete processor options on the 21.5-inch iMac. And RAM starts with 8 gigabytes and is configurable up to 16 gigabytes. But something to note here is not user upgradable. And I think the 21.5-inch model on the prior generation wasn't really user upgradable as well. You remember the 27-inch iMac, Retina iMac, has the little door. So you're going to want to make sure that you order a 21.5-inch 4K iMac with the maximum amount of RAM that you think you're going to need. In my personal opinion at this point, I think I would opt for the 16 gigabyte and not even bother with the 8 gigabyte just for future proofing. 8 gigabyte is probably enough for today for a lot of people, but I think over time you're going to want more, so you're not going to have the option to upgrade that. So do it now when you make your purchase. As far as storage goes, they come stock with a 1 terabyte 5400 RPM spinning drive, which is a little bit disappointing. I wish Apple would include a bigger drive by default. There are some build-to-order options. You can get a 1 terabyte Fusion drive, but that's different than the prior generation Fusion drive, which used to have 128 gigabytes of flash. The new 1 terabyte Fusion drive on the lower end upgrade only has 24 gigabytes of flash. Another move that Apple made that's a little bit puzzling and a little bit disappointing. Probably a cost-saving measure, but if you are going to go with the Fusion drive, you probably want to opt for the 2 gigabyte Fusion drive, which has 128 gigabytes of flash, especially if you're throwing more RAM in there, because you're going to want to make sure that you get all of your memory loaded onto the flash portion of the Fusion drive so that when you wake from sleep and do those sorts of things, it comes up nice and snappy, which is what you really want when you've got flash storage. The even better upgrade option, I think, is going with a pure flash drive. There are build-to-order options for a 256-gigabyte or a 512-gigabyte flash drive option. But, of course, these things drive up the price. So when we get to pricing here in a minute, just keep that in mind. Good news on the flash storage is it is the new kind of flash that Apple has been using, up to 2.5 times faster than the prior generation of flash. On the ports, those remain mostly the same, although you do get two Thunderbolt 2 ports. Almost had a little tongue twister there. And the SDHC card slot, 4 USB 3 ports, gigabit Ethernet, a 3.5 millimeter headset jack, and 802.11ac Wi-Fi that comes in at up to 1.3 gigabits per second. And these new models come with the new versions of the Magic Mouse and Magic Keyboard, which we'll talk about in a little bit. And you can get a Magic Trackpad, too, if you'd like, for a upgrade of US 50 bucks. So if you want to upgrade your peripherals, you can do that as well. Pricing for the new 4K Retina models starts at $1,499. The older models in the 21.5-inch, the non-Retina versions, are still available, and those start at $1,099 and $1,299. Apple did also do some minor updates to the 27-inch 5K Retina iMac. They added Skylake processors to those, so you'll get the 6th generation Intel Core i5 quad-core, at 3.2 gigahertz. It starts there, and then you can upgrade to an optional Intel quad-core i7 running at up to 4 gigahertz. And there's a few options in between there. On the 27.5-inch, you do have discrete GPU options, actually quite a few of them now. You get the AMD Radeon R9 series. They have an M380 with 2 gigabytes of video memory, an M390 with 2 gigabytes of video memory, an M395 with 2 gigabytes, and then on the high end, there's an option for a Radeon R9 M395X, and that comes with 4 gigabytes of video memory. RAM on the 27-inch models starts at 8 gigabytes also, but it's configurable up to 32 gigabytes from Apple, and as I mentioned earlier, is still user upgradable. So if you actually want to do an aftermarket upgrade, you can probably save a little bit of money. In fact, OWC came out not long after they updated these models and mentioned that you can actually get up to 64 gigabytes of RAM into the 27-inch iMac by using 4 16-gigabyte modules. So they have 4 slots in there. And if you go with their aftermarket RAM, but it will cost you quite a bit, that RAM upgrade from OWC is US$1,195. So quite a big upgrade, but that's, you know, that'd be a screaming machine. 64 gigabytes going with, say, the quad-core Intel i7. But you're likely going to be price-wise running up against maybe Mac Pro speed. So it'll be interesting to see how those two models, you know, compare out. But with the Mac Pro, of course, you're going to have to find your own 5K Retina display. Apple hasn't upgraded their Cinema displays yet, which is another thing that I find really odd. I'm not really sure why they haven't upgraded their own displays, if they're just planning on getting out of the display business altogether. But that thing is long in the tooth, and I know many of you are wondering the same thing as I am. Getting back to the 27-inch iMac, storage on it is stock with a 1 terabyte, again, 7,200 RPM spinning drive. I think it's probably time for Apple to start moving away from spinning drive options. Again, I think this is one of those cost-saving things for Apple. There are options to get the 1 terabyte Fusion drive. And again, remember, it only has 24 gigabytes of flash. So if you're getting more RAM than 24 gigabytes, you probably want to avoid that option. The 2 terabyte Fusion drive with 128 gigs of flash and the 3 terabyte Fusion drive with 128 gigs of flash are also an option. And then on the pure flash storage upgrades, you have a 256, 512, and 1 terabyte flash option. And then ports, those remain the same. 2 Thunderbolt 2 ports, the SDHD card slot, 4 USB 3.0 ports, gigabit Ethernet, the headphone jack, and 802.11ac Wi-Fi. And it comes with the new Magic Mouse 2 and Magic Keyboard with the option to upgrade to that Magic Trackpad 2. And now the base configurations are priced at US $1,799, $1,999, and $2,299. And with the 27-inch models, there are no longer any non-Retina options. So pure Retina on the upper end of all of the iMac models. But some nice updates to the iMacs. Again, I'm having a hard time figuring out the 21-inch 4K iMac. In its base configuration, I think it is not as good a value as the 27-inch model, but that's just my personal opinion. I'd love to know what you think. If you want to send me some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. Let's talk a little bit about the new Magic accessories. Apple did upgrade their keyboard, mouse, and trackpad, all three of them across the board. One of the biggest new additions to the models is that they are now all rechargeable and include a lightning cable. So they each have a little lightning connector on them. You plug that into USB either on your Mac or into a wall charger, and you can recharge them. Apple says the devices will go about a month or more on a single charge with typical use. So how we define typical use, I guess, is up to Apple. But they should last about a month for most users. The trackpad and keyboard can actually continue to be used while they're plugged in. They have the little dock port kind of on the back of the device. The mouse itself cannot. The charging port, oddly, is built into the bottom of the mouse. So once you have it plugged in for charging, you really can't use it. And for me, that was a little bit of a concern when I first read that and saw some of the images of it docked in and charging. But Apple says that you can get a full day's charge, about 9 hours of charge, in just 120 seconds. So these things are pretty fast charging, so that really shouldn't be an issue with the built-in batteries. They pair instantly also when you connect them to the Mac using the cable, and then you can disconnect and use Bluetooth after that. So that's a nice little feature if you've ever struggled with kind of pairing a device via Bluetooth. And they do all require that you are running the latest version of OS X, 10.11 El Capitan. Little more specifics on each individual item. The Magic Keyboard is 13% smaller, so physically smaller, but still full-size keys. I think the keys actually might even be a little bit bigger. There's also less of an incline in terms of the angle as it sits on your desk because that battery bump is gone. So they sit a little bit flatter to your desk. Whether or not that's good for you, I guess, is up to your own personal preference. I kind of like it a little more inclined. I'm not sure how it would feel about the flatter sort of keyboard. So I might be sticking with my Apple wireless keyboard for a little while longer. Apple mentioned that they added a new scissor mechanism to the keys that they say make the keys more stable. Now, keep in mind, this is not the same butterfly mechanism that is in the MacBook keyboard. I've been hearing that sort of reported. Apple developed a new mechanism for the super thin MacBook, I think because of the thinness of the device, and that actually is a different design from the traditional scissor switch. Now, these are redesigned scissor switches on the new Magic keyboard, so I'm not sure how those are different than the butterfly ones. I guess we'll have to get in and look at the little technical drawings, but I don't think they're exactly the same. Now, reportedly, though, from people who have used the new Magic keyboard, they say the feel is very similar, that it doesn't feel like it has a lot of travel, and a lot of people don't really like that. A lot of people like more travel in their keys, like to be able to feel and get that tactile response. So reviews on the new Magic keyboard have been a little bit mixed. Another interesting note is that the keys are now printed in the new San Francisco font that Apple developed for iOS 9 and is now in OS 10 El Capitan. And good thing this is this is the new San Francisco font, because had they used the original one, I think that would only be a keyboard loved by maybe kidnappers or people who need to write ransom notes. And that's just a reference, if you don't remember, to the original Susan Kare San Francisco font, which came on the original iMac. And the new Magic keyboard sells for US $99 and is available now. And the Magic Mouse 2 doesn't look a whole lot different than the current Magic Mouse. Apple does say, though, that it is lighter and sturdier. They also apparently redesigned the feet, or what I call the rails. If you ever looked at the bottom of a Magic Mouse, it kind of has these two long black rails. And I guess Apple's engineers didn't like the sound of it. It does kind of make a sound, especially if you're using it on a hardwood surface or something like that. So the new rails are supposed to give it a smoother glide and have it generate a lot less noise as it's sort of scratching around your desk. It does use the same old multi-touch. They did not add any new force touch technology to the Magic Mouse 2, but it does have the integrated battery being rechargeable, and it sells for US $79, which I think is up about 10 bucks from where it was being sold before. The keyboard, I think, is up in price, I want to say 30 bucks. I thought the keyboard had dropped down to $69, but I might be wrong on that. My memory may not be serving me correctly. And then finally, you have the new Magic Trackpad 2, which I think is the most significant update to the peripherals. It is gorgeous. It is much wider. Apple says it's a 29% larger surface. It has the same low profile as the new keyboard, so the two together actually line up really nicely. And the new trackpad also has force touch. So it has four sensors in there to detect where you're pressing and how hard you're pressing. Applications have been upgraded to support the new force touch that was first included with the new MacBook. So that translates to support for the new Magic Trackpad 2. There's also a Taptic Engine in there for feedback, although I've noticed in using it that it's very, very subtle, much more subtle, I think, than the Taptic Feedback or the Taptic Engine I get on my iPhone. Apple does claim that the new trackpad requires Bluetooth 4.0 capable Mac. The other two peripherals, the Magic Mouse 2 and the Magic Keyboard, still work with the older Bluetooth 2.1 or 2.0. Now, that said, I went ahead and purchased a new Magic Trackpad 2 thinking that I would use it just plugged in if it didn't work via Bluetooth, but I was able to actually use mine via Bluetooth 2.1. And so far, I haven't noticed any issues. One thing that's been cropping up online is some people are speculating that on older Bluetooth Macs that maybe battery will be an issue, that maybe it needs the Bluetooth 4.0 to use the low-energy Bluetooth. But so far, my battery life seems to be okay, and it doesn't seem to be depleting any faster than anyone else that I've talked to. Just taking a quick look right now, I've been using it for about 3 days solid, almost 4 days solid, and my battery is at 81%. So I'll keep kind of playing around with it and seeing how it works, but so far so good. All of the Force Touch stuff works. And Jason Snell actually wrote up an article and reported similar results. So I don't think it's going to be a problem on older Macs. I'm not sure why Apple is specifying that requirement, but just so you know, they officially don't support older Macs. So if you have one, you may be dealing with a few issues here and there. And pricing on the new Magic Trackpad, that was the biggest price increase because, again, I think the old one was $69. The new Magic Trackpad will set you back US $129. But that is all the latest on the Apple hardware. Now moving on to recent software updates. Apple did release a update for OS X El Capitan. 10.11.1 is out. It's mostly a minor update. It looks like it's focused on bug fixes, but there are some notable enhancements. Apple says it improves the installer reliability when upgrading to OS X El Capitan. I know some people moving from OS X Yosemite to 10.11 did run into some issues, so hopefully those have been resolved with this update. It improves compatibility for Microsoft Office 2016, which was one of the big problems for a lot of users doing the El Capitan upgrade, some incompatibilities with Office, specifically with Outlook. And I think we talked about that on the last episode of the MacCast. It also reportedly resolves several mail issues, has fixes for audio unit plugins. That was another one of those areas where early adopters to El Capitan were running into issues with their audio equipment and audio gear. So if you were a musician, there were some problems there. And especially if you rely on those audio unit plugins, those should be working better now. I'm not sure if they're totally fixed. So let us know if that improved things for you. And also overall improved reliability of VoiceOver. And then the other big kind of big thing, I don't know how big this is, but a lot of people are very excited about it. Apple added support for over 150 new emoji, including things like the burrito, the middle finger salute, and adding a unicorn. So OS X 10.11.1 now with more unicorns. iOS 9.1 was also released. It's actually the first major update to iOS 9 since it came out in September. One feature that I'm particularly excited about is live photos apparently can now sense when you're raising and lowering your phone and will not record those parts of your live photo. Anybody who has tried out live photo and used it knows that when it was released on iOS 9, it was great. You would hold up your phone, but because it records a second and a half before and a second and a half after you press the shutter button, oftentimes at the end of your live video, you'd get kind of just this motion of the phone being pointed down toward the floor. Apparently, that's not going to happen with iOS 9.1. I haven't personally had a chance to try it out, but I'm going to trust Apple on this one, and I think that's a nice little update. iOS 9.1 also adds those 150 new emoji. They've improved performance of the multitasking user interface. It has fixes for Calendar, Game Center, Mail, and the Apple Store. If you're a Sprint customer, apparently you can now also get enhanced Wi-Fi calling in the United States. And the update apparently activates the news app for users in the UK and Australia. So if you haven't grabbed iOS 9.1 yet, go ahead and run your software update. It should be available. Apple also issued a minor update to the Apple Watch, Apple Watch OS 2.0.1. It includes performance improvements and bug fixes, also support for the new emoji, and fixes an issue that caused some software updates to stall. And, you know, software updates on the Apple Watch, or just even installing software on the Apple Watch, I think still is way too slow. I'm not really sure what's going on there, but hopefully Apple can address that with future software updates. Maybe it's a little bit improved with watchOS 2.0.1. There was also an update to iTunes 12. iTunes 12.3.1 is out. There wasn't a lot of information given on this one. Apple just simply states that it improves overall stability and performance. There was also an iMovie update for OS X and iOS, basically adding in 4K video support or video editing support, both on the Mac and on the iPad Air 2. You can now import videos from the iOS app onto the Mac app so that you can continue editing them on the Mac. And Apple on the Mac side added 10 additional filters that were brought over from the iOS version. And then lastly, Apple issued updates to their iWork applications, both on iOS and OS X. New versions of Pages, Numbers, and Keynote are out. Version 2.6 on iOS 9 and 5.6 on OS 10.11 El Capitan. In iOS 9, they added support for slide over, split view, and picture-in-picture multitasking, support for the new shortcut bar and keyboard shortcuts when you're paired with a Bluetooth keyboard, support for 3D touch on the new iPhones, and more accessibility support through VoiceOver. Over on the Mac side, again, support for split view and force touch. You now get haptic feedback when working with images and things on force touch devices. And this does work with the new, I can confirm this works with the new Magic Trackpad 2. Again, very subtle, but it's very interesting when you're grabbing an image and sliding it around or a text box and it's snapping to the guides or locations, you actually get a little feel, a little feedback as you do that, which is kind of pretty cool. And then also on the Mac, more accessibility support through VoiceOver. So it sounds like a lot of the updates across the board are fixing or improving VoiceOver support, which is great for accessibility. But that is all the latest on Apple's hardware and software updates. Tim Cook was the opening act at the Wall Street Journal D Live conference, which happened in Palm Springs, California this week, and he let loose with quite a bit of information that we wanted to know about, and that was very interesting for a man who said that Apple was going to be doubling down on secrecy. So he did open up a little bit, but not completely. One thing he remained coy about was the Apple Watch sales numbers. And he even fell back to turning to his customer satisfaction number, simply saying that customer satisfaction on Apple Watch is off the charts. And when he was asked directly about the sales numbers, he said, you know, we sold some more recently, and we plan to sell even more. And I'm super paraphrasing his quote there, but basically he wasn't giving up any information on numbers. And that hasn't really stopped analysts from trying to figure out what they are going to be. Analysts have really been all over the place on this. And I'm sure they would have liked Tim Cook to have revealed the numbers so they could have the numbers from the horse's mouth, so to speak. But they didn't get it. Fortune is reporting that they estimate the average sales based on a bunch of different analysts at about 3.95 million, almost 4 million Apple Watches sold to date. Although the numbers across the board for various analysts seem to range from about 2.5 million all the way up to a very positive 6 million. Tim Cook did hint at that event that the low numbers that analysts are predicting are quote unquote likely wrong. So I have a feeling it's going to be right there in the middle around that 4 to 5 million range. Again, Apple is not going to give the numbers, even though they are having a fiscal fourth quarter call next week. Apple Watch will not be broken out. And so speculation and rumor and analyst estimates are really all we're ever going to get. One thing we'll be able to do kind of when we get sales numbers is kind of predict, although Apple Watch is lumped in with a bunch of other products like iPods and accessories and those sorts of things. So it's going to be hard to figure out an exact number, and Apple's not saying. One thing we have seen that's an interesting report, and this came from Swiss Watch Exports, is that the Apple Watch does seem to be impacting the Swiss watch industry, at least really significantly in the price range of the Apple Watch. They said that they saw the largest quarterly drop in watch exports, Swiss watch exports, since 2009 in this past quarter, with watches in the $200 to $500 segment falling the most dramatically at 14.9%. And a lot of that is being attributed to smartwatches like the Apple Watch. I don't think it was all Apple Watch, but a lot of the reports were pointing at the Apple Watch as the major contributor. And Apple really has been aggressive on getting Apple Watch into third-party retailers. That should help with sales, especially going into the holiday season. We now know that Apple Watch in the U.S. is available at Best Buy stores. They've opened up retail locations in the U.K. and Europe, and also, I think, in Asia. And it was just revealed this week that they are going to be selling Apple Watch in Target stores in the U.S. as well. So Apple being very aggressive about getting Apple Watch into all the places where consumers may want to pick one up. Also at that conference, they said that Apple Music now has, or Tim Cook specifically said, that Apple Music now has 6.5 million paying customers and 8.5 million more on free trials. So that's a total of 15 million customers still using Apple Music. Now, that's about one third as many subscribers as Spotify has, paid subscribers. And, you know, that may sound like not a significant number, but it does put, I think, Apple Music off to a good start in the music streaming business. You got to remember, Spotify's been around for a very long time. Apple has not. And when comparing revenue from those subscriptions, Dave Hamilton over at the Mac Observer wrote an interesting piece, and I'll link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, about some of the key differences between Apple's paid subscribers and Spotify, specifically pointing at the family plans, or how you get multiple subscribers within a individual family on the plans and how much it costs. With Apple, for $15 a month, you can get up to 6 users on Apple Pay, whereas on Spotify, each additional user you get at a 50% discount, and depending upon your plan, that means you're somewhere in the range of $6 to $10 per additional user. So that first user is $10 and then 6 to 10. So a family of 4 on a Spotify plan, if everybody is on a paid plan, is going to generate a little bit more revenue than on Apple Pay. But in terms of value, if you're looking for a music streaming service to get your family on and you have more than 2 members in your family, Apple Pay is something to seriously look at, because you're going to get a better deal with up to 6 users for $15. So I found that very interesting, and it may be an edge that Apple can exploit to get more paid subscribers on the Apple Music service. What wasn't mentioned, and I don't think we really know this, is how does Apple count paid subscribers? If people are on a family plan and they have 2 or 3 people, is that 1 paid subscriber? Or is that 3 or 4? And I'm sure they're not going to let us know in their numbers, but I'd be curious to know how that works in terms of reporting and things like that number that Tim Cook threw out at the Wall Street Journal DLive conference. Moving back a bit to that upcoming fourth quarter earnings results call from Apple. Of course, now the blogosphere and analysts are spouting off how they feel Apple will have done for the quarter. We're going to find out officially next week. But just so you know, analysts' average estimates of iPhone sales are coming in at 48.72 million units. And that is up from 39.72 million units sold last year. To me, I don't know what you think, but that seems like a massive increase. That's an increase of like 9 million year over year. And while impressive, I have to temper that when I remember that Apple did add China as a launch country this year. So it'll be interesting to see how many or what percentage of the sales of iPhones this time around went to China versus the rest of the world. And that may account for some of that large increase. Piper Jaffray analyst Jean Munster thinks that Apple will report quarterly revenue of $51 billion. That would absolutely blow away the $39 billion that they posted for the same quarter last year. I would imagine that the new iPhones, along with Apple Watch sales, are contributing factors to that large revenue growth. Also, maybe a little bit of Apple Music thrown in there. It's going to be interesting to see how much revenue generation Apple Music actually accounts for. Again, I'm not sure that Apple is going to break it out, but I'm sure analysts are going to analyze and try and do that for us. So it'll be interesting to see how they factor in those numbers. But a few other numbers being thrown around by analysts. 57 million iMacs, which would be massively impressive. 5.7 million iMacs versus 5.5 million from last year, and 10.5 million iPads down from the 12.3 million Apple sold last year. Of course, iPads have been on the decline, or iPad sales rather have been on the decline for Apple. Ming-Chi Kuo, though, says the worst for iPad will be over. I'm not really convinced it was ever really that bad. I think it was just a normal leveling, and I think it was something Apple probably knew was going to happen and account for as the iPad product matured. But everybody has been spelling doom for the iPad because sales have been slowing year over year. Well, Chi Kuo says it's over now because the higher-priced iPad Pro is coming out, and that will essentially offset the slowing, declining tablet sales. So while sales will decline, he actually believes that Apple will ship about 2 million iPad Pros in the holiday quarter and thinks that 2016 shipments will continue to decline 16% in terms of iPads sold, but the revenue will stay more stable because Apple is going to be selling more higher-priced iPads like the iPad Pro. So whether that will bear out or not, who knows, but we are going to get a chance next week to hear official numbers for the quarter from Apple. So stay tuned for future coverage of that on an upcoming MacCast. And then the last big item I want to talk about from the Wall Street Journal event with Tim Cook was Tim Cook let slip that the new Apple TV, and I don't really think this was a slip, just for the record, so don't email me, but he did officially announce the date of the new Apple TV going on sale, which is going to be this Monday, October 26th, and they will ship by the end of the week. Now, I've seen some reports saying that they'll be shipping on October 30th. It's not clear whether you're going to receive shipments that day or Apple is actually going to start shipping them. Tim Cook just said shipping at the end of the week, so I don't know that we actually have a firm date on when new Apple TVs will be delivered, but you certainly will be able to order your new unit on Monday. And I will be in that batch. For those of you who are wondering, I do plan to buy the larger storage version, the 64 gigabyte. And my main rationale for that is every time that I've ever bought a new Apple product and sort of skimped on the storage, at some point in the future, I've always come to regret it. Maybe not on day one, maybe not even in the first year of usage, but in the second year. And I generally don't buy Apple TVs all that frequently, so I think I want to have the most storage, especially with the new apps and games coming. I recognize that Apple has set hard limits on developers in terms of how much storage they can use on the device, but just in terms of volume and also TVs and movies, it's not clear how the caching for that sort of stuff is going to work when you're streaming, and it'd be nice to have a larger cache buffer on my device. And being only $50 more for double the storage, I think the value is worth it, but you're going to have to make your own decisions on that and decide. But that is what I'm doing in case you are curious. Apple has also invited developers now to submit their applications, getting ready for the launch. One notable change to app developers is in the app review guidelines for the tvOS is that all apps now must support the Siri remote, at least for the core application functionality. This was a change that Apple had made for games, I believe, but I don't think it extended to all applications. Now all applications are sort of covered under this guideline, according to reports in the blogosphere, and apps can offer enhanced experiences via other controllers and third-party devices, but the apps must remain functional using only the included Siri remote for all their core basic functionality. Good news on the app front, too, is Plex has come out and said that they are going to be in the App Store on launch day, or they plan to be there. So if you are a Plex fan or were planning to use your Plex server with your new Apple TV, you should be able to set that up and get that going. Another side thing that happened this week, not related directly to the new Apple TV, but rather to the older TV, is that CBS and NBC finally added their channels to the current Apple TV software. So if you have an Apple TV 2 or 3, you will notice you have new CBS and NBC channels. The CBS channel offers access to CBS All Access, which is a direct subscription service. For $5.99 a month, you can view current primetime shows, leading daytime and late night CBS programs, and thousands of episodes in the network's library of classic TV shows. You also get access to live TV streaming in select major markets, at least ones where the CBS network owns and operates their own over-the-air station. Again, you have to pay for that service, $5.99 a month. And then Apple also added a new exclusive fashion channel called M2M, or Made to Measure. And apparently that is only available on the Apple TV and is a new channel that will eventually roll out to other areas. But for right now, Apple TV exclusive. But with the addition of NBC and CBS, oh, and I also forgot to mention the NBC app is the more traditional kind of channel where you actually have to authorize and verify that you have a cable subscription to be able to access the NBC content. But with NBC and CBS now on board on current generation Apple TVs, I guess that brings the big four networks in the States all onto the Apple TV platform. And in case you're wondering about Apple's TV, you know, streaming service with the new Apple TV, I know Tim Cook came out and said that apps are the future of television, but we are still hearing rumblings that Apple is trying to work out deals for an Apple TV streaming service. And this week, the latest came from CBS's CEO. He told Bloomberg that Apple is having conversations with everyone about doing their own streaming services. And from his statements, it really made it sound like it's a matter of when and not if Apple is going to do a streaming TV service. Of course, he had no insight on when the deals might be reached or when the service might hit. I would say sometime in 2016, but I'm really not holding my breath. I think Apple wants to get it done sooner or later, but they've just been bumping up against too many obstacles. And if you've listened to prior episodes of the MacCast, you probably know my theory on it, which is that Apple wanted to get a streaming TV service out for the new Apple TV, was unable to make the deals happen, and just decided that, hey, we're going to go with apps. We're going to open up the app platform that works really well with iPads and iOS devices using AirPlay to the Apple TV. So why not just open that up, open those APIs, and just let the individual channels put their apps on there for now. And then if Apple can ever reach deals at some point in the future, they can update the Apple TV and get more people onto Apple's TV service. The other thing that Apple's probably doing is trying to get more in general Apple TVs into the market. The more Apple TVs they sell, the more people they have using Apple TVs, the easier it is going to be able to sell a streaming TV service to the networks, because Apple can point and say, hey, look at this giant consumer base of people we have on Apple TV. Imagine if you can get them paying X dollars a month for a streaming TV service. Whether that will work or not, I don't know, but that does seem to be a strategy and a road that maybe Apple is going down. Remember all those reports of the anti-glare coating kind of sloughing or flaking off of some Retina MacBook Pros? Well, it's looking like now, at least according to reports from Mac Rumors and others, that Apple has implemented a repair and replacement program for that issue, though they're not really publicizing it. They're not really letting anybody know. So we're going to let you know, and the blogosphere and Apple blogs are going to let us know as well. Apple is reportedly replacing displays on affected units for up to 1 year from October 16th, 2015, or within 3 years of the date of purchase of your Retina MacBook Pro, whichever happens to be longer. And so far, Apple has said nothing officially about this, and sources couldn't really tell Mac Rumors what the criteria for screen replacement eligibility is, but we have had reports of people going in and being able to get their screens covered even outside of the traditional AppleCare warranty. And reportedly, geniuses and folks within Apple have commented or made comments that this is an official program. It is part of their system now. And many of the images that I've seen online, if you've been impacted by this issue, are really awful. If you've seen any of them, they look really terrible. Some people have described the effect as staining, but to me, it more looks like the coating is either peeling off or scratching or even kind of wearing away. You get this rainbowy, splotchy. It's just really terrible. Anybody who's ever had anti-glare coating on a pair of glasses and seen that come off, you probably know what this looks like. And why it's happening, a lot of people have speculated that it could be the result of some sort of chemical reaction, maybe to lotions or sweat on people's hands, but it's really not clear. Some have actually taken to calling this event Staingate, but let's not do that. I'm so tired of the whole gate thing, aren't you? Let's not do that. Basically, it is a issue with the Retina MacBook Pro anti-glare coating. And if you think you have an affected unit, then now would be the time to contact Apple, get it in, have it looked at, and see if you can't get the issue resolved. I think this story also serves as a general reminder to be careful about what products, and I'm not saying this issue is being caused by overcleaning or products, but some people are. But just in general, it's a good reminder that if you are cleaning your display, you want to be very careful about it because it does have very sensitive coatings and anti-glare things on it. And so you absolutely want to make sure that you're never using any kind of solvent or household cleaning product on it. I specifically, when I'm cleaning mine, I try to use no more than just a dry, clean microfiber cloth. You know, one of these cleaning cloths that you can get. They're very easy to get. They're very inexpensive. And I try to use that. If there's smudge or smuts on it or something that's a little more globbed in or, you know, kind of smeared on or something like that, something greasy got on there, then what I tend to do is just take one of those same cloths, dampen it just slightly, squeeze out all the water I possibly can so it's just barely damp, and then just use that, just regular old clean, you know, water. And I've even heard some people, you know, have taken to using like distilled water or even something a little bit safer. The key point is when you're cleaning the screen, you want to make sure that you're not putting any chemical on there and that you're not getting any liquid down into the cracks or the edges. You don't want water seeping under the screen. That could cause a lot of problems. And harsh chemicals can literally damage the coating that are on your screen. And you want to make sure you have a clean, dry cloth. Make sure, you know, there's not any sand or any grit because you don't want any scratching or anything like that. Try to be very careful out there with your screens. But if you have been impacted by the Retina MacBook Pro issue, it does look like it's some sort of like the coating just wasn't applied properly on certain units. And I'm not sure how widespread it is, but those people who have been impacted, it is significant enough. So it is good to see that Apple has put together a program, even if they're not officially announcing it. And then finally, in the news for this week, a little story popped up related to Apple's electric car project. As a matter of fact, it came about because a company called Mission Motors, who have been developing an electric bike or electric motorcycle, rather, called the Mission R, came out and said that they had to shut down because they were losing too many people to Apple, or at least that's the claims the CEO was making. The company actually ceased operations in May and I guess filed for bankruptcy in September. The CEO was claiming that they may have been able to keep going, but they lost too many key staff and engineers to Apple and other companies like Tesla and Google. In reading the full story, which appeared over on Reuters, though, I would say that the company was struggling way before Apple got involved, and it likely wasn't too hard for Apple to woo away their employees, because if you have ever worked at a company that is struggling financially and having issues, it's often not a fun place to work, and you worry about your job security. So when someone like Apple comes along, or Tesla, or Google, and says, hey, we really could use you over here, you're probably going to consider that offer very seriously and go to the place where you may feel a little bit more secure. So still the story is here, and I think it is another strong sign that Apple is pretty deeply involved in the development of some sort of electric vehicle. As you know, we've also been hearing these reports of Apple grabbing engineers from electric and autonomous vehicle companies like A123 and Tesla for more than the past year. We've been hearing about buildings and R&D facilities, so it's pretty clear that there's some sort of project going. Just as a final note, though, Tim Cook was asked about it at that Wall Street Journal thing, and again, he wasn't giving up any information and letting on that Apple was working on a car project, kind of just like he did with Stephen Colbert. But between you and I think Apple's working on an electric car. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile. You know, I'm a big fan of Smile and all of their products. One of the ones that I use a lot and really like is PDF Pen Pro. And if you need to work with PDFs or edit PDFs, and let's be honest, in this day and age, who doesn't? PDF has kind of become that universal format. Then PDF Pen 7 and PDF Pen 7 Pro, I think, are absolutely essential tools that you need to have on your Mac. You can use it for all sorts of things. Things like annotating and marking up your PDFs, managing your pages, doing small text edits. If you need to add a table of contents, PDF Pen 7 Pro is great for that. You can use it to add signatures and fill out what I call fake forms. These are PDFs that you get that look like a form, but nobody took the time to actually build in the form fields, so you could actually fill it out as a form. You can use PDF Pen and its text editing tools to put text onto those forms, so you can do everything digitally. And for forms that you want to turn into actual PDF forms, PDF Pen can be used to do that as well. You can also add proofreader marks and comments and bunch more stuff. I've really been using it for forever. But if you need help getting up and running, if you're like, it sounds interesting to me, I'm not really sure what I'd use it for or how I'd use it, David Sparks has produced a great set of tutorial videos for Smile over on their website. And if you go to smilesoftware.com/maccast right now, you can find those videos. And he covers things like how to annotate a PDF, adding signatures, performing OCR, correcting and redacting text, and a bunch more. So you could see all those and then pick up your copy of PDF Pen 7 or PDF Pen Pro 7. The latest versions have been designed to work with OS X Yosemite and are ready for OS X El Capitan if you've already upgraded. They have an updated UI that matches the design of Yosemite, and you also now have the ability to proofread your OCR text from your scanned pages. If you have PDF Pen 7 Pro, you can actually edit that OCR text. They have compatibility with iCloud Drive, so you can sync across all your devices. And PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad is great as well. So you can use iCloud Drive syncing across the platforms to make sure that you have all your PDFs with you wherever and whenever you need them. So check it out. Go to smilesoftware.com/maccast. Access the David Sparks videos and get more details on the product. And while you're there, check out all the other great stuff that Smile has to offer. Big thank you to Smile for their continued support of the MacCast. One of the stories we talked about on the last episode of the MacCast was Apple finally releasing the official Apple Watch lugs so that third-party watch band makers could make officially sanctioned, made for Apple Watch bands. And I was particularly excited about that because although I know a lot of alternative watch bands have been out on the market for a while, I worry about the mechanism not being officially, you know, the official Apple ones not being made for iCertified or made for Apple Watch certified. And part of the reason I said I worried about that was an issue I heard from some folks and reported some different places about metals and how mixing and matching metals in some cases can cause or potentially lead to corrosion. So I was wondering a little bit about that, and I asked you if you happen to have any insight or if you had heard anything similar to get back to me. And I received this reply from Gary.
Hey, Adam, maybe I should listen to your whole podcast and then record, but I can't remember it all. I'd have to write down and take notes. I just listened to the component of how Apple Watch is coming out with their own made for Apple lugs for Apple Watch, which I think is great. I'm really hesitant in buying things off of Amazon or other places, even though it's super awesome, super cheap. You know, I don't like buying stuff that I really don't know how it's being manufactured or what the materials will be like when you have them. I'm more apt to pay a little bit more if I have that confidence that the part is awesome. So, but with that, I wanted to comment on the metal interaction. I forget what the Apple employee told me, but I went in with my aluminum Apple Watch in black. So it's like black anodized aluminum. And I really like that black stainless steel watch band. Obviously I have a little bit of concerns, if you remember back, with the weight of the watch. But I did love that band. It looks really awesome. And then it's really awesome to have it on the black aluminum. It's a little bit of a two-tone look because the aluminum anodized is not as shiny as the, I think, black stainless steel that goes with the band, but it kind of looks awesome together. But the Apple rep said, you got to be concerned because, actually, first of all, he had no idea that he even sold them. I'm like, I'm pretty positive it just was released that this is being sold. And he's like, you know, let's look it up. And I'm like, you don't need to look it up. It's pretty much 100% right on that that you sell it now. It's $449. And he insisted on looking it up. And he's like, wow, I can't believe it. That's an awesome band. So we talked about it. He said that when you put those two metals together, it, like you said on the podcast, it reacts or something happens where it leads to corrosion. And I was talking to a friend that's an engineer. And he said that, yeah, it's true that if you have, he didn't say specifically which metals, but maybe potentially any two differing metals, the aluminum and or stainless steel together, as they get like salt water or, you know, liquids, sweat combined with that salt, it causes ion exchange and it can cause the metals to corrode over time. What speed that happens at, or is it significant enough that it even warrants a conversation? I don't know. But that's what the Apple guy said. He said, you don't want to mix those metals. And I said, well, why would they sell that, even though they didn't before, but why would they sell it now and not actually educate or present, you know, like a disclaimer that says, if you're, you know, mix only with this metal. So it made me place another, you know, call out to you about if I would decide to put those stainless steel bumpers on to have maybe a leather band, would that be an issue? I don't even know if the silver would look good with that, but it might. It might. So I wanted to follow up on that. Not sure. Thanks.
Hey, Gary, thanks for the feedback and the additional information. It's really interesting to me what the Apple Store rep said, because I went back and I looked at the page for the official, you know, made for Apple Watch lugs, and those are actually stainless steel and the only option as far as I know. So I would imagine that means that if you're getting a made for Apple Watch official third-party watch band, you're going to have stainless steel lugs on there. And if you're combining that with an Apple Watch Sport with the aluminum, how does that work with the information that it sounds like you've heard, which is the same as what I have heard, that could potentially lead to, that mix of metals could lead to corrosion. Maybe stainless steel and aluminum are okay together. I really think we need to kind of discover some more information on this. I'm hoping there's somebody who really knows the chemistry behind it, a chemist or a metallurgist or a materials scientist, if you happen to know, and can maybe give us the official thing. Maybe what I should do is a little bit of my own Googling and my own research to get to the bottom of this story. But I can't imagine that Apple is going to come out and say that third-party watch bands are only compatible with the stainless steel version of the watch. I don't think they're going to be incompatible with the Apple Watch Sport. So maybe it's like you said, maybe the corrosion or the reaction times are just way too slow, or it's a total non-issue in real world usage, that this is something that would have to occur over, you know, decades or eons of time to show up or even be an issue. But I'd love to get to the bottom of it, and I still do really appreciate your feedback. As I mentioned at the top of the show, I have bit the bullet. I have jumped in and made the leap to OS X El Capitan. And the reason is because I wanted to try out the new Magic Trackpad 2, which is really cool and I really, really like. My original Magic Mouse had kind of had this problem for a while where it would no longer turn off. The power button kind of stopped working. And while that didn't impact the day-to-day functionality, it was just one of those things that always bugged me. So for years now, I had been thinking about replacing my Magic Mouse. And when these new trackpads came out, I thought, hey, here's the perfect opportunity, and then was immediately disappointed when I saw that they were Bluetooth 4.0 because I have a 2011 15-inch MacBook Pro, and I don't have low-energy Bluetooth. I don't have Bluetooth 4.0 in that. And I thought about trying to use an adapter, and I even went down that route just for those of you who are trying it. I picked up an adapter. I had an IO Gear Bluetooth 4.0 adapter that plugs into the USB. The problem was, is under El Capitan, I could not figure out how to get the Mac to recognize it. It's fully supported, and apparently even in the kernel extension, it has support for this specific unit, but no matter what I would do, it would still want to connect on the internal Bluetooth. And there apparently used to be a tool that you could get through the development toolkit to allow you to specifically select the Bluetooth controller that you wanted to use on the Mac. But in the latest Xcode update, Apple has also removed that tool. So that tool is no longer available. So if there's someone out there that knows how to use a third-party Bluetooth adapter with OS X El Capitan, let me know. Shoot me an email or send me a link to an article or a how-to on how to do that. I would love to know it. But that didn't work. So regardless, I was going to use, as I mentioned earlier, the trackpad just wired in via USB. And I did that. I plugged it in. And then I noticed that it paired up just fine with my Bluetooth. So I got curious, what happens if I unplug the trackpad and try it that way? And lo and behold, it worked perfectly fine. So that was sort of what kicked this thing off, is that I wanted this new trackpad. And then they even mentioned this to me when I bought it at the Apple Store, which I think was nice. She said, you know, you need to be running the latest version of the operating system to use this. So I thought, okay, I want to use this. I've been holding off on upgrading. It's probably time for me to go through my update. And if you've listened to the last episode of the MacCast, you know one of the reasons I was holding off was I wanted to double check compatibility with my software and specifically some of the web development tools that I used. And I did do that, and everything seemed to be mostly okay on that front. The other thing I had been kind of holding off for is I wanted to do a full erase and like clean install, and I mean a really clean install of my operating system, where I was going to hand migrate all of my documents and my mail and all of that stuff. I wasn't even going to use the migration assistant. And that's an extreme thing. It's not something that anybody really needs to do. So if you're wondering, hey, Adam, why did you do that? I had just done a lot of over-the-top upgrades for the past several years, and there was just a lot of crud and cruft on my hard drive. Specifically, my library folder had grown to this massive, unmanageable size, and despite running all the tools for cleaning stuff out, it still wasn't really getting any smaller. So I just wanted to start from zero, square one, with a fresh, clean operating system, all freshly installed applications, and only bring over the documents and data that I really, really needed at this point and cared about. Of course, I did all my backups, and I have all kinds of archives of data, so I wasn't going to lose anything, but it was just a matter of time. It was a time-involved process. And if you've noticed the date on this MacCast, that should give you some insight into why there's been a little wider gap between the show and the last show than there normally would be. But anyway, I did it. I made the jump, and I have to say it went relatively smoothly with just a couple little bumps in the road. I will say the biggest bump in the road turned out to be iCloud Photo Library. And I don't know if this is because of how I did it. I didn't notice anybody having this issue when they just did an over-the-top upgrade, and I haven't heard reports of this problem. But for me, despite copying my full old library file over and firing, you know, photos back up and resetting up and returning on iCloud syncing, it seems to want to resync all of my photos. And that just totally cratered, just like it did the first time when I first enabled iCloud Photo Library, totally cratered my network connection and my bandwidth and just caused all kinds of issues. It also popped up a message saying that it was going to use up more iCloud storage than I had available. So it was like telling me it wasn't going to match up all the stuff that was already uploaded and put into my iCloud photo library collection. Now, I think that is just a little bit of a UI problem. I think given enough time, it's going to recognize and it's going to check the differences and it's going to see, oh, I already have all of these photos. I don't need to re-upload them. And I think it's going to resync up, but it's a matter of time. And so what I elected to do was turn off iCloud Photo Library for now and just kind of deal with that later. And dealing with it later means that I'm going to turn it on in the evenings when I go to bed. If I can ever remember so far, I haven't remembered to turn it back on. And I may just bail on it. I've talked to a lot of people since then, and a lot of people have run into similar issues with iCloud Photo Library and syncing. For me, you know, that first sync was pretty painful, but once it was all done and up and running and on all my devices, it's been running fairly smoothly for me. I haven't had too many issues. So I'd like to get it turned back on, but I'll report back later on how that process goes. But that certainly did cause a problem after upgrading because it literally slowed down my system to where it was totally unusable. So again, not something I'd recommend. And again, it may be my specific issue with iCloud Photo Library may be related to how I'm doing the upgrade with this sort of complete clean install and hand copying files back over. The second problem that I ran into, which was one that I was prepared for, I was kind of ready to hit, and that was with system integrity protection and some of the low-level, you know, Unix-level development and coding tools that I use for doing my web development work. So, I don't think this is a big issue that's going to impact a lot of you, but if you are a web developer and you use things like Homebrew and some of these other tools, there's just some things you need to know about. Apple has locked down some specific folders, and really you have to kind of make sure that all your tools that you're using install into the user local folder. And for me, it turned out just doing some quick Googling and Stack Exchange for a few of the little tools that I had issues with solved the problems. And a lot of that just involves creating some symlinks to make sure that stuff is moved and referenced into that user's local folder. And as a matter of fact, I asked last time for feedback on those from those of you who had made the transition to El Capitan, just on how your experience went. And Forrest was very much in the same boat as I was when it came to upgrading a development Mac to El Capitan. And he had this to say about the whole experience.
Hi, Adam. My name's Forrest, and I'm from the East San Francisco Bay. And you invited us to call in with our El Capitan upgrade experiences, and I thought I would because I'm, just like you, a web developer who uses Grunt and Homebrew and Sass, and I'm part of a team that has a pretty complex development environment also involving Python. And so initially, I got involved in the El Capitan public beta program, and I tried to install it into a Parallels VM and put together my development environment from scratch there. And that didn't quite work because there was a version conflict in Python. But once the final public beta rolled around, I tried it again, and it all went pretty smoothly. And I got my development environment running in this VM. And when the final public version came out, I actually have the same development environment on both my work iMac and a personal MacBook. And so I first upgraded the MacBook, since if things went wrong there, that wasn't really all that damaging to me. And I had just slight problems with Homebrew, where I would do a brew upgrade, they would generate an error, and so I'd do a brew upgrade again, and then it would work fine. The one slightly odd thing is that Brew Doctor recommended that I do a recursive chown on the user local directory, and after I did that, everything went very smoothly. And with my work iMac, since I had so much success there, it went even more smoothly. I did have to install Xcode 7.0.1 on both systems, and after I did that and did Brew Doctor and Brew Upgrade and changing the ownership on user local, everything went amazingly smoothly. Far more smoothly than it did when going from Mavics to Yosemite. Really enjoying it. I find I'm using the split screen mode for my multiple terminal windows, and that works out really well, especially on the big iMac screen in its own workspace. And so I thought you might find that interesting, and hope you have as smooth a transition as I did. So thanks a lot. Thanks for all you do. I've been listening for a long time.
Hey, Forrest, thank you for that feedback. Yeah, mine has gone, as you have heard, relatively smoothly, again, with just a little of the hiccups and bumps. I figured after listening to that again, it's pretty technical. For those of you who don't know what's going on or when we're talking about homebrew and brew upgrade and these sorts of things, what you just need to know is homebrew is a package installer, basically a software installer for lower level like Unix and terminal level things, different tools and utilities that we use. And it's just a tool you can use to keep that software up to date, much like Apple's, you know, software updater for your Mac applications. It's similar for those sorts of tools. And that's what's going on there. But yeah, other than that, things have been fairly smooth so far for me. Up and running with El Capitan, I would say performance in general seems to be, for me, a little bit better than it was in Yosemite. Although I am seeing the occasional odd beach ball. I kind of like the look of the new beach ball. I know that's a little controversial. Some people don't like the flat spinning pinwheel or beach ball icon. But I'm seeing that from time to time, and I'm not really sure why. Right after I upgraded, I did notice it was happening more than expected, but then realized that spotlight indexing had kicked in. And again, I think this was because I didn't do an over-the-top upgrade. I was starting completely from scratch, so Spotlight had to rebuild all of its indexing and databases. And as you know, that can slow things down on your system as that's running. Also, another thing that I turned on immediately and was actually part of the upgrade process was File Vault 2, which encrypts the entire hard drive, and that can take up some processing power. I'm surprised that Apple actually prompts you to turn that on during the install process. And if you are upgrading or installing from scratch, rather, you probably want to say no to that initially. Get your Mac all set up and then go ahead into the system preferences, into security, and turn that feature on later, kind of after you have everything set up, because I think it did slow things down as I was installing. And once you've sort of enabled it, you have to wait for it to do the entire encryption before you can disable it. So at that point, there's no point. You know, it's been encrypted, and any new things are going to fall under that encryption. So I wouldn't, you know, having to do it all over again, I wouldn't have opted to select that option. But things also did seem to get a little bit better in terms of the beach balling after the 10.11.1 update. Other general things I've noticed as I've been running El Capitan, I did have one full kernel panic at one point for some reason. I'm not sure why that happened. It seemed to coincide with me messing around with the Bluetooth 4.0 adapter, so it may be related to that. My iSight camera also didn't work for Skype when I went to do the Mac show this week, so I had to reboot, and that was simply fixed by a reboot. I don't know why that happened, although Don McAllister said he had the same thing happen to him. My audio interface also does seem to keep switching to 48 kilohertz, which makes me sound like a chipmunk when I'm doing Skype calls, but that's an easy fix. You just open up audio MIDI setup and change it from 48 kilohertz to 44.1 kilohertz, and that pans out. But I don't know why it keeps switching back. I've had to do that a couple times. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, GarageBand 6.0.5, the older version of GarageBand, which lets me do the chapters for the show, has some color issues. It actually seems to work just fine, but in the editor and the timeline, the colors are all off, almost like inverted. They're this purple on purple, and it makes it really hard to work with the timelines. So I'm trying a new workflow with the latest version, and we'll see how that goes. Hopefully, you don't have any bumps in the road in the audio that you're hearing me on now. If you do or notice anything weird, just shoot me an email, mattcast@gmail.com, and I'll look into it. But we're going to be transitioning workflows for a little while, so little things here and there may crop up, and just warn you about that there. But other than that, everything seems to be running great. All my software applications are running great. My development tools, no problems there. I am on the latest versions of everything. So I use the latest version of Office. I use the latest version of, you know, iWork and all the Apple tools other than GarageBand, which I'm now on the latest version now. And Photoshop and all those sorts of things. I know if you have legacy applications, there kind of can be some issues, but I had done my pre-check just like I advised in the last show, checked all of my software and knew I wasn't going to run into any big problems with my critical applications. I probably haven't been using it long enough to find the little odds and ends applications that I use occasionally, but I'm sure some of those will crop up. But in general, I've been very happy with the El Capitan upgrade. Now, not everybody in the community has been totally happy, though. There have been reports of a few issues that I just want to point out to you, just in case you're thinking about upgrading or maybe you've run into some of these. The general slowness and beach balling for some people, that seems to be an issue. Hopefully that's being resolved as Apple puts out more and more updates. There's been the known issues with Office 2016, but Microsoft is working on a fix for those. And as was noted, there was a fix in the 10.11.1 update. Some people have been reporting issues with iTunes being slow and unresponsive. Maybe the new iTunes update will address some of those. Wi-Fi and AirDrop issues. And then our friend Victor Cahiao noticed a strange one with his 27-inch 2011 Cinema display from Apple. After upgrading, it suddenly became unrecognized, and Apple support said they were getting a lot of calls about those issues. So if you have a 27-inch 2011 Cinema display, you may want to be aware of that. In Victor's case, it sounded like they were having him reinstall the operating system from scratch. So I don't know if that was just an over-the-top upgrade. I was just following him on Twitter when I saw those things, and I haven't heard the result of that. But if you've run into issues with a Cinema display, let us know, especially if you have a way to fix that problem or issue. Myself, I use a, you know, just a standard Thunderbolt display, and I've had no issues with that. It's just a standard like 24-inch HP display, and I haven't seen any other reports of other customers having issues with external displays beyond the 27-inch Cinema display. And then finally, listener Doug emailed me to point out that if you do use iWork and you've upgraded to El Capitan and you have the upgraded version of iWork, if you have files that need to go back to a Mac that's not on El Capitan, you will run into problems. I guess there's not backward compatibility for iWork on non-El Capitan Macs. So you know, take that into account when you're considering your workflow. But that's how it's been going for me. How's it been going for you? Share your experiences with us. Let us know, good, bad. You know, we want to know all of it. And especially if you've run into an issue and you have a solution for it, somebody else might be running into the same issue. So share that with the community. Share that information. Shoot me an email or an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com, and we'll try and get those on future episodes. Let's talk about AppleCare for a little bit. I am a pretty big fan of AppleCare. I get it on most of my devices these days, including now my iOS devices. I didn't in the past get it on iOS, but I had a couple accidental damage issues and have decided to opt in for it more often than not. And Diego actually emailed me this week specifically about AppleCare for iOS. He wanted to let me know about some trouble he ran into when he went to add AppleCare to his iPad 2, which was reaching the end of its standard one-year warranty coverage. You may or may not be aware with AppleCare, most Apple devices come with 1 year of standard AppleCare. The AppleCare Plus that you get on iOS devices, you have to pay for, and that's the thing that includes things like the accidental damage coverage. But you get a year of standard coverage, and Diego was looking to extend that. And he contacted Apple or was looking on the Apple website to see about doing that, and he noticed something specifically about AppleCare on the iPad. It said that it either needed to be purchased at the time of purchase or within 60 days of buying his device. And he, like many of us, believed that you had up to a year after the purchase of your device to actually add on AppleCare, and that would still be covered beyond the original warranty. And that was very true for Macs. And I actually kind of knew the policy had changed with iOS devices, but honestly, I had not thought about it because I almost always buy AppleCare when I buy my device. But Diego asked, what's changed? And why do you no longer have a year to purchase your AppleCare? And Diego, the reason is basically that AppleCare Plus, and more specifically, I think, and I'm just speculating here, but I think it's the accidental damage protection, because the policy basically changed when Apple added AppleCare Plus and got rid of the standard AppleCare warranties. And what's going on is if you don't buy AppleCare at the time of purchase, I think the concern is that, you know, someone might opt to not buy AppleCare, run into an incident where they have accidental damage, and then quickly buy AppleCare and then try and get it covered retroactively, kind of after the fact. So you weren't really covered by the protection, and then you're trying to kind of weasel your way into it, I think is probably how Apple's looking at it. And so now they've instituted this policy that you either need to buy it with the device, or even if you buy it within that 60-day period, so they kind of give you a 60-day grace period. So if you don't buy it right that day, and then you're like, maybe I should get it. If you buy it within that first 60 days, then you actually have to get your device inspected. So Apple can look at it, make sure there's no accidental damage, it hasn't been already dropped or something like that. And you have to do that either at an Apple retail store. You also have to bring a proof of purchase. And I find that interesting because a lot of times, especially if you bought it at the Apple store, I would think they'd have it in the computer records. But I think you actually have to have a copy of your email receipt or something to show them. So you have to do it that way, or you can call in on AppleCare, but when you do that, they actually make you run a diagnostic tool and send a report back to them, and you also have to provide that proof of purchase. So my advice on iOS devices moving forward with AppleCare Plus is if you're at all thinking about getting it, get it at the time of purchase. It's just going to make everything a whole lot easier. But that's the reason for the change. Now, on Macs, you still do have that one-year grace period, but that's because your Macs don't have that accidental damage protection. Now, if Apple ever changes that, that grace period could, I would imagine, potentially change. But that's what's going on. And since you brought up AppleCare, I thought this would be a good time to mention a few other things. There was recently reported a couple stories on Apple's policy on AppleCare refunds. A lot of people don't know that you can actually get a refund on AppleCare if you buy it and then choose to discontinue it, or maybe you buy a new device and you sell your old one and you don't need the AppleCare on that device anymore. You can get a prorated refund. And it's also especially good if you're like me and say you buy an iPhone, you get AppleCare with it, and I buy mine outright. If I go to upgrade next year, I have to buy AppleCare on the new device, and maybe I can get a little bit on the AppleCare that I'm not going to be using on my old device. Now, in my case, really technically, I tend to hand down my iPhone, so we just transfer that AppleCare or keep that AppleCare, and that is another thing that you can do. I'll talk about that here in a minute. But if you want to get a prorated refund, you can cancel your AppleCare plan within 30 days of your date of purchase. You'll get a full refund at that point, minus any value of any service already provided. So if you've used your AppleCare, you know, kicked in that accidental protection program or something like that, I think you lose some of that value. If it's past 30 days after your purchase, you can cancel your AppleCare plan and you will get a refund based on the percentage of unexpired AppleCare coverage, again, minus the value of any service that has already been provided. And there is a support page that actually details all of this. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to look into it. But basically, you have to contact Apple and tell them you want a refund. And I don't know if it needs to be done in writing or what have you, but all that information is on that support page. And then another option, as I mentioned, is you can transfer your AppleCare. And a lot of people don't know you can do that. And this is especially useful if you're going to sell your device, because if you have a year left on your AppleCare, you can say, hey, I will sell this and you can get a year of warranty coverage along with it. And the way you transfer it is you just need some bits of information from whoever you're selling it to. You need their name, their address, their Apple ID, basically the email address attached to their account at Apple's website or in iTunes, so that, you know, when it's registered, they know who it goes to, and then a phone number for the new owner. You get all of that information, and then you just call up AppleCare or Apple support, and you ask to be transferred over to the AppleCare people. Tell them you want to transfer AppleCare from, you know, one person to another, that you sold the device, and they will help you out with that. You just give them the information, and then they can transfer the AppleCare. So a couple good bits of advice on AppleCare, and thanks, Diego, for your email. Now, lastly, in the show for today, I have my thing of the moment for you, something that I have been using and playing around with that I am particularly excited about. And this can generally be hardware, software, you name it, anything related to Mac or iOS. And this week, what I have for you is another product from the folks at Orbotics, the makers of the Sphero. And specifically, it's the special edition of the Sphero designed to promote STEM principles: science, technology, engineering, and math. And it's called the Spark, S-P-R-K edition of the Sphero. The folks at Sphero actually sent me the Spark kit, and I've had a blast with this thing, playing with my kids, and they're learning all kinds of things related to math and engineering and problem-solving skills, coding and programming. It's really, really cool, and I'm having a lot of fun with it. The kit includes this special edition of the Sphero, and if you've ever seen it, or in case you don't know what the Sphero is, it's a little ball that is really a robot. There's a lot of technology in there. There's LEDs, and you can change colors and things like that, and it's controlled via your smartphone or Bluetooth device. So you can use an Android smartphone or an iPhone, and you can drive it around, have it be remote controlled, but it is also through some apps that Sphero has available, programmable. So you can play around with this thing. And in the Spark Edition, what you have is the standard Sphero 2.0 is kind of a white, it's translucent, but not see-through. You know, it's like a white frosted plastic casing. Well, the Spark Edition is actually totally clear. You can actually see it, see into it. You can see all the bits and parts and pieces and stuff like that. And that's particularly cool. In the box, it comes with the Sphero, an induction charging base, because it's, again, totally sealed. So you charge it through induction charging. And this kit also comes with a little pencil, a little notebook for taking notes, and kind of this pop-out cardboard protractor and ruler so that you can actually do some of the little science experiments and testing and things like that. And it really has this focus on robotics and coding, which I think is really cool. And maybe it's just the geek in me or because I'm a web developer, but I really think this can help inspire kids learn about science and math and engineering. And so I wanted to mention it in this episode. Like I said, it's clear. You can see everything inside of it. It's still sealed, which I think is really good for durability and safety. When I got it, though, I thought, hey, it'd be really cool if it was hackable, if you could actually open it up and maybe do some things with the hardware like you would with an Arduino. But considering that it's for schools and teachers and students and stuff like that, maybe this is the right compromise. You can see in, actually in the software, they give you a cool exploded view so you can see what all the bits and parts are. But maybe you don't want, you know, kids messing around with those. You got batteries and electricity and stuff like that. It could be, I guess, potentially a little bit dangerous. But the hacker in me kind of wants to get in there and mess with the guts of it. But beyond that, what you can do is you can download the Spark application, which is free on the App Store. And then you get a little block code editor, and it comes with several kind of sample programs to get you started so you can run these and kind of see what it does. And basically you get little blocks with actions that you can drag into a script and put together controls and basically program your Sphero to go on different paths or react to different sensors. You have actions, you have controls, you have operators, you have variables. You have access to sensors and events, and you build these into a little sequence or a program. And if you've used Automator or Workflow or even Sketch, you kind of know how this works, right? You drag the little blocks. Maybe you set a couple variables. You can set events and things like that and react to events. You can set up loops and controls and basically build out this whole program visually without actually having to write any specific code. And then when you tap run in the Sphero application, the Sphero actually goes out and executes your program. And you can save all your programs into the app and come back and modify them. When I first picked it up, started messing around with some of the built-in example programs and then tweaking them, seeing how I could get the Sphero to react and stuff like that. And you can control pretty much everything in the Sphero, the speed, the handling, even down to the colors of the LEDs, even the little indicator LED that you set up for configuring the direction that it's pointing in when you're first starting out. You can control that. You've got your typical if then else and loop structures. You can set up and control variables and use operators. You can access the sensors, which include the heading, the speed, the vertical acceleration, the axis accelerometers, and you can even detect things like when it has a collision, when it bumps into something, or when it's going through a free fall, and you can build programs that react to those events as well. And it uses a C-based language that was developed specifically for the Sphero called OVAL. And if you want to get more advanced, actually in the Spark application, you can go in and directly edit the code. So you can even see the code structure And there is an oval reference in the app, so you can see what the APIs are and what the function calls are and mess with variables and do that stuff manually if you don't want to use the visual editor. So what's cool about it from an educational standpoint, I think, is that you can really grow. You can start students off with something very simple, just in terms of some of the macro applications that they have, and then move them into maybe the visual code block editing application, and then move them on to actually writing code directly for the device. And another nice thing that Sphero has done is they've added support for some third-party apps. So there's a really cool app called Tickle in iTunes, and I'll have a link to this in the show notes at maccast.com, that lets you set up simple UIs and programs that can interact with Sphero devices and actually other devices. It looks like it works with drones and some other Bluetooth-connected devices that you can get for your iOS. But Sphero has worked, and Orbotics has worked with the folks who developed the Tickle application, and you know, you can have little icons on screen, and then tapping or pressing those icons can control your Sphero, or you can get access to the iPad's tilt sensors and have the Sphero react to those. So it's cool that even beyond the application that Sphero gives you, you can get into some of these other third-party apps. And right now there looks like there's two, and I'm hoping there's going to be more. But that was a lot of fun to play around with as well. And then lastly, they're trying to do a lot to really help teachers and educators integrate the Sphero and the Spark into their classroom. So if you go to the website, they have videos, they have lesson plans, and help for educators, even all the way down to helping get funding for different programs. So they can show you where you can get some grants and how to put together sample grant applications and letters, maybe go find business partners in your community to help kind of fund some of the STEM programs that you want to do in your school. So I thought those were great. And then on top of that, they give you the core lessons and middle school lessons and STEM challenges that you can use with this Sphero Spark. And those include teacher guides and student guides, as well as worksheets. So you kind of have everything you need to kind of build an in-classroom program to use the Sphero as part of your lesson plan. And that, I thought, was really, really cool. A great thing that Sphero is doing. As far as pricing goes, the Spark Edition is $129 US, and they do have educational discounts. So if you're an educator, and they do have kind of like a 12 Sphero classroom set that you can get. So if you're trying to, you know, build out a program in a whole classroom, they have solutions for you, and you definitely should contact them and check it out. But you can head to sphero.com/education to see all of the details about the Spark. And we've been having a blast with it. So I wanted to bring it up, and it's definitely my thing of the moment for this week. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a couple of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, along with Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices, and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can check out their software, get more information and details, and check out those great David Sparks videos on PDF Pen 7 and PDF Pen Pro 7 over at smilesoftware.com/MacCast. And I'd also like to thank Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, and I really would like to hear how your El Capitan upgrades are going, you can shoot me an audio comment or send an email to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to leave voicemail on the listener hotline. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you want to follow me between shows and you're on social media, you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast, or you can find us on Google Plus at our Google Plus community. That is google.com/plusmaccast, and the plus is the plus symbol, just to make that clear. But with that, that's going to do it for this episode. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.